Welcome back to the CTO Playbook, the podcast dedicated to helping CTOs excel. I'm your host, Adam Horner. With 30 years in the industry, including over a decade as a CTO, I have coached and mentored more than 100 engineers and tech leaders. This podcast covers crucial topics for CTOs, providing insights, strategies, and practical advice to help you build and refine your own playbook to excel as a CTO. Today's episode explores one of the most challenging aspects of the CTO role: building and managing human capital. This isn't just about hiring and scaling a team, but about creating an environment where your engineers thrive, where productivity soars, and burnout is kept at bay. Joining us is Gareth Thomas, an accomplished CTO with over 25 years of experience working with Fortune 50 companies and tech startups. Gareth has shaped high-performing teams across industries and geographies, bringing invaluable insights on how to nurture and develop technical teams. He shares why it's crucial to identify key players, like fire jumpers, who bring unique value to your organization in surprising ways. In this episode, you'll discover Gareth's people-first playbook, including practical steps for fostering empathy, creating a healthy work-life balance, and guiding engineers from ambition to senior individual contributor and leadership roles. His insights will help you rethink how you approach the human side of technology leadership. So settle in as we get into this essential conversation with Gareth on the human capital aspects of being a CTO. Gareth, welcome to the CTO podcast. How are you doing?
I'm good, Adam. Nice to see you again.
Excellent. The playbook, of course, is where we're recording at the moment, but we've actually been on video before, haven't we?
We have. You did a Tech Captains episode, and I was just saying to you, you were one of the few guests that actually asked us questions, so you turned it back around, which I thought was really good. And so I thought it'd be interesting to come back on here, because I think you do that quite a bit on your show as well. So I'll ask you some questions as well. I'll put you back in the hot seat, hopefully.
Always fun to do that, definitely. Well, let's just get a little bit of an introduction to you then, talk about your background. So because you're a CTO at the moment, aren't you? But how did you get to that point?
Oh, so yeah, I started out as a software engineer, software developer, long time ago, back in the 90s. So that's dating myself here. I worked in television, I worked in banking, worked on finance systems, worked on back office banking systems, which was incredibly boring. And then I was actually offered a job in the United States. And I moved over to the US. Worked in California, worked in Los Angeles, which was amazing. It was one of those things where as a kid, I'd always wanted to go there. And then I finally got there. And I ended up through another sequence of steps, having my own software company for a while. And in that process, I kind of realized that I actually liked, while I loved coding, and we actually created a startup, we did lots of crazy things, I really enjoyed the process of managing people and sort of understanding the business side of things and I eventually think I liked that more than coding, because I started coding when I was quite young. Then when I came back to the UK, I actually got a contract with a company that was based in New York. And that sort of led into a senior management role. And then from there, I sort of started going into CTO roles. And I've been in, I don't know, five or six of them now. I've done some interim CTO roles as well. But I've just found that it's just something that I ended up enjoying a lot more than being a coder. I got quite burnt out on coding, would probably be a really short answer as well.
That sounds like a bit of a story there. So how did you end up getting burnt out on coding then?
Well, I mean, so the company I had in California, we spun up our own startup and we were funding that ourselves from the other business. There was myself and two other people.
So it's like an in-house venture then, kind of thing?
It was an in-house venture, yeah. And we had some big customers. I mean, we had people like Hitachi and Toshiba. We had some quite large companies using the software that we built. And it was just one of those things where you are working all the time, you know. So on the one hand, we had other customers in the consulting business that we were, you know, talking to every day, doing work for every day. We had some salespeople who were actually selling a product as well. We were selling an accounting system. That was another sideline that we had. So with that happening.
A sideline in accounting systems. That's quite ambitious.
Exactly, as in accounting systems. Yeah. And then we started doing this software product. And so there was just, I just got tired of it, really. I was working all the time. We were coding on weekends. And eventually I just fell out of love with it. And I always say, you shouldn't do something unless you love it. And so I think the point that I thought, because I used to live for it, was one of those guys, I'd be up coding till 3 or 4 in the morning. You know, I used to love assembly language. I was pretty hardcore coder at one point. And I just realized one day I didn't love it anymore. And I think, yeah, you shouldn't do something if you don't love it.
And so did that see then as a transition for you purely into the leadership, or did you have a bit of a tie to somewhere else first?
No, I mean, that was it. And the thing is, which is a bit of perhaps what we're going to get into today, is the first time that you do it, you realize there is no, you know, I didn't have any experience. No one had actually sat me down and explained to me, this is how you manage people. This is how you run teams. It's, and I think this is the case for a lot of us, right? You sort of drift into it, you find you enjoy it, but you don't really, there's no formal education. No one actually, I mean, maybe there isn't some bigger companies, I'm sure that perhaps there are, but I'd never had anyone sit me down and explain to me, this is how you run a team and this is how you manage people. And so, you know, the first time that it happened and I was doing this on, you know, on a small scale with my own business, it wasn't that large a company, I realized that I didn't have a lot of these tools and I needed to figure out, you know, how do you do this? But then I realized quite quickly that actually this was something I was reasonably good at. And then I really started to enjoy it. And I still enjoy it today. I still love the aspects of building and scaling teams. I think that's it's one of the most fun things of being a CTO. It's one of the hardest things, but it's one of the things that I enjoy the most, actually.
Yeah, so in terms of building teams, then there's obviously a very high people element to that. Do you think your own experience of sort of falling out of love with the coding aspect of it played into the way that you look after and manage people as you recruit them?
That's a great question. And yes, I mean, definitely the case. I'm very aware of the pressures that we're putting guys on, you know, well, guys, you know, men and women, and especially young people who come into it now. You know, there was always that expectation of working all these hours. You know, there were stories about why Facebook would only hire people that were, you know, less than 30 and all the rest of it, because they were the ones that had no family, no responsibilities. So you could push them and you could burn them out. And that was okay. It's not okay. It's not acceptable. And you're not getting the best out of people when you're constantly doing that to them all the time. So yeah, I think it did. It does shape how I look at managing teams and how I deal with people. I'm constantly aware that, you know, I could be doing to them what was done to me. Now, I did it to myself. Let's be clear about it. I didn't have a manager, you know, cracking a whip behind me. It was something I was doing to myself because it was my own business. So,
but the pressures are there nonetheless.
Yeah, the pressures are there nonetheless. But it is a real issue. And, you know, I think it's in tech as well that I think it's very hard for a lot of us. If we like solving problems, it's what I say to my wife because she gets annoyed. I'm always trying to fix things, right? I'm always trying to figure out what the problem is with something. She tells me to shut up sometimes. But that's what we do. We're problem solvers. And so I think when you have that mindset, it's hard to switch that off. It's hard to, you know, be coding or whatever all day as a coder and then sit at home after dinner and you're thinking through something. Oh, like, you know, if I changed it, if I, you know, used this library or did this way, it's really hard to then not go back and keep coding. I completely get it. I completely get it. It's an obsession when you're really into it like that.
And do you think the environment that you're in, you know, West Coast of the US, where coding is sort of the, you know, one of those sort of epitome roles, do you think that added to the and level of pressure that you put on yourself to keep solving problems and to keep going?
Maybe. I mean, but there's also a US thing, right? Because I think Americans in general work harder. They have a stronger work ethic, perhaps, than maybe we do in the UK. They certainly don't have the holidays. I mean, you're lucky to get 10 days holiday after 5 years at a company. That you're lucky to get that, right? I mean, they look at the holidays we have here, they can't quite believe it, that we're getting 24 days a year from the start. So there is definitely a different work ethic in the US. And, you know, I wasn't in Silicon Valley. I was in the South. I was in the Bay Area, perhaps a little bit different. But certainly, I think if you're up in there, in the Silicon Valley area, there is a very much a, it's constant, huge amount of pressure. I mean, and big salaries as well. It all comes with it, right? A lot of demands.
Cool. And so in terms of your experience, and you obviously had this time when you sort of burnt out, decided you're going to do it a different way. What did you immediately change? And what did you do in a different way to get to the point where you felt like, okay, now I'm in a good space again?
Well, I stopped coding. it was kind of forced upon me, right? Because we ended up having to shutter the business. You know, again, there was a real learning experience there. The learning experience was we had one company that was generating a lot of money as a consulting business, and we're taking, you know, the excess cash and shoving it into this other business. And then after 9/11 occurred in the US, I don't know if it was really apparent here, but it really hit the US economy for a couple of years. And these big customers that we had, a lot of the businesses that we were working on the consulting side with, they did, you know, they stopped that. So our cash flow stopped on one side, and where we should have been saving cash, we've been pumping it into this other company. So we ended up being in a position we had to shut the business. And so the end of that kind of hardcore imposed coding was, you know, really forced upon me. Now, saying that, I went from there to doing some contracting for this company that ended up being based in New York. I was still coding at that point, but that was, it was very different then, really. It wasn't something where it was like, you know, 60, 70, 80 hour weeks. It was something a lot more normal at that point. But it was during then that I started thinking, yeah, you know, this isn't really for me. This isn't something that I love anymore. And I started consciously trying to get away from being a coder and moving into something else.
Right. So you had a transition role where you were sort of...
I had a transition role, I would say, yeah.
Cool. Okay. And then what was the opportunity at the other side of that transition role that you created for yourself or that you found that enabled you to step away from the coding once and for all? Or not once and for all, because I know you... Once a coder, always a coder, but you know, that step away from it as being sort of the main part of your day-to-day work.
Well, it was really just the business that I was at. So they scaled very, very quickly. So I was in Edinburgh at that point. I opened an office in Edinburgh and hired some engineers in Edinburgh. We actually had an office then in New York and we just grew quite quickly. There was a lot, the company grew very fast and really it just transitioned automatically or sort of naturally, I suppose, from a day-to-day coding into now you're managing a bunch of coders to now you're sat in, you know, meetings with the CEO and talking to, you know, investors. And it just moved quite naturally from being a coder to being someone who was much more involved in running the team and the sort of, and the other side of it really.
Brilliant. And what sort of experience did you think that you took from that sort of head down, hardworking 80-hour weeks into your leadership, scaling, and approach to the people that you brought on board? What do you think that you sort of brought across from one to the other to make it into an atypical management leadership experience?
Now, that's an interesting question. Well, certainly being, you know, one of the things I was going to talk about in when we start going to some of these sort of playbook rules, I suppose, is just you need to have empathy. I think empathy is, I actually say empathy is a superpower. And to be a good leader, and to be a good manager of people, you have to have a decent amount of empathy. And I think having been in the situation of being one of those grunts that was sat there, you know, working away, I understood the processes. I understood, you know, I think people who've never coded, there's this idea that, you know, software bugs are because, you know, coders aren't very good. And, you know, anytime they use a bit of software, it always breaks because there's a lack of quality and blah, 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 blah. So there's a lot of pressures put upon software developers by people who aren't software developers because they don't understand the process and they don't understand the realities of writing code and testing code and constantly delivering and keeping high quality. It's very, very hard. And it's impossible to create something that has no bugs in it, right? So I came from the world that understood that and then try to interface with a world that didn't necessarily understand that. That was just pure business.
So you became that translation layer between the understanding and the business who are trying to figure out, you know, what's going on and what you needed.
But I think that's the main role of us as CTOs, right? This is what we do. We're the bridge. So one of the things I tell people, so I mentor like yourself. I've been involved with mentoring programs, mentoring people who want to be CTOs or who are CTOs. And one of the first things I say to someone, especially if they say, oh, you know, I'm really keen, you know, my venture goal is to be a CTO. I say, you know, one of the things you have to understand about it is it's quite a lonely role, right? You know, if you think about being in the C-suite, you might be the only technical person in that C-suite. You know, if your CFO can have a vague discussion about balance sheets and numbers with everybody, the marketing person can talk about advertisements, everybody sort of understands each other. But the moment you start talking about, you know, asymmetrical encryption, and your cloud strategy and, you know, your backend stack. And I mean, people's eyes just glaze over. They don't know what you're talking about. So you're, in many cases, you're very much alone as the technical person within that C-suite. So I say to people, it can be a very lonely role. And I don't think a lot of people think of it like that. I mean, certainly there are C-suite, there are companies, I mean, Google, very famously, they're all engineers, right? I think so. There are companies that it's different, but in a lot of cases, you will be the only technical person in that team.
Yeah, they are the exception rather than the rule, aren't they? So. Yeah. So leading at that level. So then, so you got the empathy and you got the sort of the lonely aspect of the CTO role as well, which you obviously figured out fairly early on, I guess, in terms of that leadership process.
Yeah. And also this thing that, another thing I was, you know, people talk about is you get into discussions where they'll say, I've had mentoring individuals that I mentored who struggle with being part of that leadership team. And the reason is that they will often say things like, oh, you know, so my team's really, really high performing. And I say, well, which team is that? Well, my engineering team. Oh, but what about the management team that you're part of? And they sometimes look a bit puzzled. It's like, it doesn't necessarily compute that there are two teams. You know, you're part of the leadership driving the business forward. Then you have a team that you manage, which is the engineering team. And so you sit in these two worlds. And sometimes I think, again, there isn't this understanding that's the case. And that can be a problem. It can sometimes they can have this sort of us versus them mentality, which is obviously does not work at all. And I've seen that fail very badly.
Yeah, I think we've all seen that one quite a few times, haven't we? Where the CTO looks entirely down and into their, you know, maybe engineering leaders, maybe it's individual contributors who are reporting to them, but rather than thinking about the C-suite as their team, as their primary team, as their first team, as Lencioni calls it in the five dysfunctions of a team, they view the people reporting to them as their team, which is, yeah, as you say, it doesn't work for too long.
No, it doesn't. And, you know, I mean, you could have a whole discussion around how you build that team mentality within the C-suite, right? But which could be a CEO problem. It could be an issue with roles overlapping or unclear responsibility. It could be all kinds of things. But certainly understanding that as a C-suite leader and as a CTO, that your team is the C-suite. These are the guys that you're working with to make the business successful. And, you know, sometimes it just clicks for people one day. And it clicked for me. It clicked for me, actually, I think, when I was going to New York, because all of a sudden, rather than sitting there having conversations with the engineers about what we were building, I'm now sat in meetings where it's obviously just the C-suite or it's some of the investors or all the rest of it. And you're having very, very different discussions about the direction of the business as opposed to, you know, is this thing going to fall over tomorrow because we're going to add another 50,000 users or 100,000 users, right? So you almost feel a bit, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, you're in two worlds, right? You have a foot in, you know, one foot in each camp, really.
But for you, there was a very interesting gap between them, you know, several thousand miles in the Atlantic Ocean between where you sort of in Edinburgh, you had your team and then you had to fly over to New York to be part of that, those executive meetings where the business conversations happen. Now, that's a very interesting divide that I think a lot of execs don't almost benefit from. So do you think that was sort of helped you in terms of that physical separation and the flight to take in between those two?
Yeah, I mean, it was interesting. I mean, I worked out one year that I spent, because I would go to New York at least like once a month and usually for a week. So I'd fly on a Monday, come back on a Friday. And I worked out, I think one year I spent, you know, 3 or 4 months of the year in New York, right? But I was living in Edinburgh. It was funny actually, because around the same time, there was a movie that came out about a guy who was a hairdresser. It was a true story. And he was a hairdresser in Glasgow and he ran a salon in New York. And he flew to New York to run his salon. Then he'd fly back to Edinburgh. There's a movie about it. It's fantastic. I can't remember the name of it. But yeah, it was a strange period. And it coincided with Skype being available. So this ability to talk to people and, you know, the video calls, I think, launched maybe 2006. I don't remember. So, you know, all of a sudden it was suddenly... Yeah, it was somewhere around then. And it seemed, I remember the first video call seemed quite magical, didn't it? And so it made managing remote teams very, you know, much easier. And we had teams, I mean, there was the team in Edinburgh, team in New York. We had engineers in India as well. We had a team in India. And we had people in a few different European countries. So it was very spread out. But yes, it is, now that I think about it, I remember I used to come back from New York. And my wife would actually say she couldn't talk to me for 2 days because New York was such a crazy high energy place. I would go there for a week and come back and I was so full of like just craziness. It took me about 2 days. Yeah, it took me about 2 days to come back down from those trips to something, you know, a bit more British, I suppose.
So something like, so I'm sure there's a joke there about drinking the Kool-Aid and going with it. But you therefore then scaled your team pretty quickly. And I suppose through that process, as you just mentioned, multiple different countries, you're bringing people in. Obviously, quite a lot of different cultures that you're recruiting in, a lot of different environments. I presume a lot of different seniority levels and sort of structures of teams within that as well. So how did you sort of approach building up the team in the way that you wanted to build it with your, you know, with what you'd learned in your background there then?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? I've always been a fan of quite flat team, you know, structures. So team leads. I mean, if you take a typical stack, right? So you've got back end, front end, you've got QA, you've got DevOps, you've got all of these disciplines. So I've always been sort of a fan that you have a very flat structure within that. So you have your team lead, you have your heads of, and then really you've just got engineers underneath of them. And those, I've also been a fan of trying to promote from within. So if you have somebody there who is really strong and really good, identifying them early, being able to move them into a role where they have some more responsibilities, and supporting him through that. And I've had some, you know, there've been quite a few times, I mean, guys that I still get messages from now who was able to move into roles. And one guy in particular, when a recent company I was at, it was quite young and, you know, sitting with him in conversations, it can be very apparent that someone is far more than just a coder. The way they think, the way they answer questions, taking in the initiative on things. So it's finding those individuals, getting those people into those sort of roles as soon as you can, so that that helps you with the growth. Because obviously hiring can be very time consuming. It can be very difficult. 6 months, let's say, to get someone hired, found, you know, to the point where they're actually productive in a code base is the measure I go by. So if you can, exactly. And if you can move someone into a role that's already there because they've shown that ability, not only are they going to be happy because you're recognizing what they can do and what they're capable of, but again, I think that's another way that you can move a bit more quickly. So scaling out those teams, I've tried to, where I can, do that with internal promotions. And then, just finding people is very, very hard. And then going through the interview process, hiring, using networks of guys that are already on your teams to try and find people that they recommend has often been a route. And then, just the process that I went through of the learnings of how do you manage people, and imparting those into those individuals at that point when they realize, okay, now 50% of my job isn't coding, it's also dealing with my team, which I have a very crystal clear memory of a conversation with one guy who called me 1 week. This wasn't the company in New York. This was actually about 3 years ago, because he had a sudden realization that the job that he was very excited to do suddenly meant that half his week was now not going to be, writing Terraform code and dealing with, DevOps stuff that he really loved. It was going to be someone couldn't come in because they were sick or dealing with people. And I'm like, that now has become the reality of what you want to do. And sometimes it's mundane stuff and sometimes it's enjoyable things about how you upskill people and how you reward people. All of that's the fun stuff. That's being Father Christmas, right? I always say when you can reward people, it's like being a tech Father Christmas, basically, which is a nice bit of the job.
But then in order to be able to do that, you kind of really need to understand the individuals, their ambitions, their approaches, their skill sets and their natural inclinations. So do you have like a framework or a process that you use to do that? Because I've heard so many different variants on how CTOs, tech leaders and others sort of try and figure out who's on their team, even after they've hired, even after in some cases they've had them in their team for years.
So I think, it gets onto the first, I would say almost the most important thing of a CTO role. When I drop into a new role, like number one on my list is understanding that team and their capabilities, because that's your resource, right? If it's less than 50 people, you can speak to all of them in your first month. You can set aside a half hour, a couple of times a week, and you can cover all of those 50 individuals and you can have a conversation with them. And I always have the same conversations and I always keep notes. And it's not just around what they do, the things like, what do you do on a day-to-day basis? What do you like about how the company works? What do you not like? What do you think the product should do? What do you think we do badly? Those standard things. I also ask them about themselves. What's your background? How did you get in to be a programmer? Where do you live? Just mundane stuff, because you're also building a rapport with people. They're human beings, right? So it's trying to understand, what hobbies do they have? What do they do on the weekends? So those are I make a big effort to have all of those conversations with people in the first month. If it's more than 50 people, obviously, I managed at one point over 150 people, that's going to be quite difficult, but you can organize small group meetings by department. You can do it in ways to make this happen as part of your onboarding process. But even in that case, I would still be wanting to have regular one-on-ones with everyone. I would schedule those through the year, right? I'm going to drop in a half hour, just chat to someone. And I also call them Vegas conversations, right? Whatever happens, whatever they say in that conversation can stay in that conversation, right?
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Exactly. So understanding your team and capabilities, having those conversations, to me, that's the first thing I do when I drop into a role.
And are there any particular traits or backgrounds that you're looking for? Is there particular things you're trying to pick out of those conversations or generate to come to the surface?
Well, yeah. There's the two obvious ones are, one, are they dissatisfied with where they are? Am I joining and I'm about to lose half my team because there's some fundamental problem in the business that perhaps I wasn't made aware of when I interviewed for the job, right? Because you don't necessarily hear all the bad stuff. Well, you very rarely hear the bad stuff when you join a company. Everything's great. We're doing great. We've just raised 20 million, blah, 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 blah. Then you join and you find out, there's horrible problems with the stack, the AI guys hate the way models are built. Everything's too slow. So then the reality arrives when you start having those conversations. So it's finding out, where are the bodies? There's always bodies somewhere, finding those dissatisfied individuals and obviously then making a note that as soon as I'm in a position to do so, I want to address that because I don't want to lose. I don't want to come on board and lose 10 guys overnight because they're really unhappy about something. And then trying to find those people that we might move quite quickly into another role, right? I've had to go through restructurings a few times. And when I say restructurings, I don't mean necessarily just layoffs. I mean reorganizing because we're changing, you know, we're having additional products or we're moving into another country. So those kind of restructurings.
Right. So taking advantage of opportunities rather than downsizing. Yeah.
Right. So then, you know, trying to identify those, you know, oh, you know, I spoke to this guy, you know, Jack, and he's a senior, one of the senior DevOps guys, and had a conversation with him. It's quite clear that he feels frustrated that he could be providing more as a staff engineer because he's quite senior. He's got 30 years experience. Why is he sat here just doing DevOps stuff? And I'm filing that away going, okay, because I'm a big fan of staff engineers, principal engineers, whatever you want to call them. I call them fire jumpers. So I don't know if you know in the US, you know, they have these teams that put out forest fires, like wildfires. They have guys that they drop in by plane, quite a dangerous job. So they call them fire jumpers. And so the staff engineers or the principal engineers, I like to think of as my fire jumpers. So I can drop a guy in somewhere and he can help work with some guys to fix a problem, right? There might be a really bizarre problem that they've been trying to figure out for weeks. And you drop someone with all this experience who might go and think of something completely crazy, and he'll help, he or she will help solve that problem. So it's picking out those individuals.
I'm a big fan of that role as well. I often call them the special ops of software engineering. You know, literally drop them in behind enemy lines and sort things out. In fact, it was great when I was coaching a CTO recently, and it became apparent within a couple of weeks of speaking to this CTO who I was coaching that he really actually didn't want to be a CTO at all. And as we went through the conversation, we identified somebody else. I was like, so what do you want to do? And it turned out that he was a Marine previously. And so I said, well, you know, how does it sound, you know, to be dropped in difficult places, sort stuff out, tidy things up, and then jump out again? It's like, that sounds great. It's a fire jumper, basically, isn't it?
It is a fire jumper, yeah.
And so, yes, I'm a big fan of that role as well. I think when you can find the right people to go into that, it's a great place. So to just quickly recap then. So you're looking in those early conversations, figuring out where the bodies are, as you put it, where the skeletons are, where the dissatisfaction is in particular. And then who are the people with potential to either lead who aren't leading, or the people who are the significant problem solvers that you can drop into hard places.
Or the people that might go because they're just unhappy and they haven't really told anybody they're unhappy.
Right. So those people who are at risk as well. And do you find that you actually get those people coming forward and sort of saying, I'm really considering leaving? Or do you look for traits and markers that make you think, hang on a minute?
It's probably a bit of both, but I think sometimes you have an advantage when you're new. When you're new, and then when you set, because I always set the expectation with a call. Look, we're going to have this call. I always message people. So here's a tip as well. Don't just stick a call on a calendar with a guy that's never spoken to you, a one-on-one, because immediately they'll be stressed out thinking, I'm going to get fired. Here's the new guy. He's going to fire me. So I always will message them going, you know, by the way, I'm Gareth, you know, just come on board. I'm going to set up a meeting with you just to get to know you. So they're not stressed about this upcoming meeting with me, right?
Yeah, you don't have the up in the air moment where they think somebody's flying in to just give you the bad news.
Yeah, exactly. And I think sometimes because you're the new person, and if you set that expectation, a lot of times it will just come out. They'll feel like they can tell you because you're new, right? And you haven't got an agenda or whatever. And so I've had people just literally say within the first few minutes, you know, by the way, I'm considering leaving because of X or because of Y. Or like you say, I've kind of teased it out. Had an interesting one, which was, I hadn't had before. So a guy said to me, we started the conversation about what he did. And then he said, oh, Gareth, look, can I just stop you here? And I said, sure. And he said, you know, I don't really do these conversations. And I said, what do you mean? He said, I'm not a talkative person. And I don't need to have this regular conversation with you. So just by the way, you don't need to schedule this regularly in your calendar because you don't need to talk to me, which sort of took me back a little bit. And I said, okay.
It's a minor warning flag already.
Yeah, perhaps. And I said, well, look, you know, that's fine. You know, I'm not going to schedule something regularly with you because it's clear that perhaps that's not something that you want. However, you know, everybody occasionally finds it useful to talk. We all do. So, you know, you can message me anytime you want to have a conversation, and I will set one up for another 3 or 4 months just to check in and see how you're doing anyway. Right. And we sort of left it like that. But that was an unexpected thing to say, that I don't talk to people. So it's like, okay.
Kind of goes against the grain of building a team. I mean, sure, teams are made of individuals, but if you have just a set of individuals, well, you haven't got a team really.
That's true. Yeah. But I mean, I think that, I mean, wouldn't you say that in tech, that sort of insular you know, I just want to go into my cubicle and I want to put my headphones and I want to code. That is, there's a lot of people like that, right? I mean, it's a trait.
Absolutely. I've got a very memorable example for myself. Some years back, I was working with a guy. He joined my team. I was leading a database team and I had all sorts of people on the team. I had one guy who had actually retired and then rejoined the workforce. Had another, she was very young. She joined into the database team. She didn't really know what it was that she wanted to do. She did end up doing database in the end, but learned a lot about it. And I had this guy who had been working with data for a while, but wasn't exactly sure where he wanted to go. But about every month or so, he would arrange a meeting with me. And the first one I had with him was real eye-opener, because basically he just screamed and yelled at me for a solid 30 minutes. And I was sort of so shell-shocked and taken aback. I just didn't really know what to make of it. I listened to it all. I wrote things down. I was in listening mode, thankfully. Didn't try and fix anything, thankfully. And at the end of it, he sort of got to the end, sort of ran out of steam. At the end of it, he said, "Oh, thank you. I needed that." And that was it. He was fine for another month. And then about 60 days later, exactly the same thing. It was just like this pressure that built up. But he, again, was another one of these people who didn't particularly speak to a lot of people around the team, didn't really speak to other people in the other teams, but he still needed to speak to somebody. And it came out in this way. And after the first time, I was sort of ready for it. I was able to sort of brace myself incoming. But yeah, that happened about four times before he then shifted off onto a different team elsewhere. I warned his new manager that would happen. So
yeah, I mean, I think we've all, it's the most complex part of the job, right? I mean, if you look at what we do, you know, working in these businesses, tech companies in general, there are technical solutions. We're not trying to put people on Mars. You know, we're not SpaceX, right? That would be amazing, but we're not there. You know, most of the time, we don't come across insurmountable tech problems. So the real complexity comes from people, comes from the teams and building the teams. And those sometimes can be almost intractable problems, right? Where you end up having to do something sort of drastic to deal with it. But I think it is, as I said earlier at the beginning, I think it's actually the hardest, one of the hardest parts of the job is dealing with people, not the tech.
Absolutely. I think what, I mean, you described one of the aspects really well there, which is just trying to figure out who you've got in your team. What do they want? Because one of the other things to try and deal with is ambition. Most engineers have ambitions to do something. Some want to move into leadership. Many want to just be, you know, really, they just want to learn more and be more senior and get more respect, you know, learn more frameworks, more technologies. And then very few of them think about when they start sort of teaching, mentoring, or giving back. And even fewer, I find, think about leadership. Now, you spoke about promoting from within and making sure you can try and figure out who there is within your team to promote up. How do you handle that situation where everybody wants to get more senior and everybody wants to, you know, go up the pay rise and up the stack, but it is kind of a pyramid by definition. It gets thinner at the top. So what are your strategies and approaches to handling that aspect of the word I really hate is human resources, as like people are just things to be used?
Well, I think it's been made a lot easier in the last, 10, 15 years, right? Because we've had the rise of the individual contributor. You know, it used to be that, yes, if you didn't have an ambition to be a CTO or a director, you know, one of those other sort of top tier titles that you had, that then there was no path for you really. If that wasn't something that you were capable of or wanted to do, then you were going to get to a certain point and there wouldn't be a role for you anywhere. So I think one of the things today that we have that's really good is this individual contributor, right? Someone can stay and be a coder until they're put in the ground, which I think is fantastic, because this whole notion of the sort of gray beard, right? Guys with incredible experience as coders have been doing it for 30 or 40 years. They have huge value in writing into a code base. And I think it's unfortunate too that it was always like, well, they're too expensive. I'm not going to keep this guy. But you know, then people saying that don't understand the value of someone, the experience that they bring into a code base. I mean, I can remember, you know, when I was coding, you know, you probably had it as well, is that when you've been you've worked in a code base for long enough, you almost have an intuition about where a problem is. Well, when I say almost, you have an intuition. So there'll be a bug that's reported. Oh, you know, this you know, thing over here is generating a, you know, there's a rounding error that's appearing every, you know, third Monday of February, right? We don't know why it's happening. And you just sit and you just sit there and you go, oh, I think I know where it is. And you don't really know how you know where it is. And oftentimes, you know what, you're right. And I can remember having that on a number of occasions where there'd be some bizarre problem and you just kind of knew where to look. And that just comes from deep experience of that code base, right? So now you think about someone that's had that over 20, 30 years with a particular language, with a framework, multiple frameworks. They've got huge abilities to help you track down problems, to mentor other individuals. So it makes me really happy that we have this role.
It is unevenly distributed, though, the recognition of the sort of the senior individual contributor, though, isn't it? Because I find there's some organizations where it's very much up and out, or up or out. And other organizations where there is generally this, yeah, as you said, the gray beard and the respect for the people who've got all that time in the business. I mean, not always men. Often I find some of the people who have got the best instincts are women engineers who can just pinpoint fairly rapidly, as you said, exactly, I think it's over there. And if it's not the first thing they look at, it's often the second. But I do find it's unevenly distributed. There are some companies that really get it, and then leadership structures just don't.
Oh, it's definitely the case. But again, I think that is again where you have organizations that don't understand writing software, that don't understand software development. They don't understand the process. It's a highly creative process. It's a process where, you know, you do need peace, you do need quiet. I mean, this notion of these big rooms of cubicles. I worked in a cubicle when I was in LA and it was horrible, right? You can't focus and concentrate in those environments. It's too noisy. So it's a very creative process where you get deeply into a zone and you're highly productive. And, you know, it is hard for people to understand, I think, the world that coders swim in unless they've been there, which, just as an aside, is why it's really bizarre to me that apparently there's even such a thing now, CTOs with no tech background. I don't even know how can you have the T in CTO if you don't have a technology background, but apparently it's become a thing where there's actually people who are getting to be CTOs who've never written a line of code in their life, which I just boggles my mind, if I'm honest. So yes, I think there's people don't understand the process, and that's fine. I mean, if you've never built stuff, then how could you? But then you should be listening to what individuals like us are telling you. If we're part of the leadership team and we're saying, look, you know, I need to be able to pay X amount to engineers who've been here for, you know, 15, 20 years, very senior people, because they bring a huge value to the code base, to the other members of the team, you should be able to make that case. And it shouldn't be hard, right? It should be a very, very easy case to make, actually.
And so part of the people aspects of being a CTO, therefore, is representing these folks in the leadership conversations in the business as well. Because I find that if you can get that empathy going both ways, you've got empathy for engineers, you understand the things that they're facing, but you can also relay that to the other leaders to, yeah, as you said, explain why this salary is worth it for this person who's been in the business so long, or why we need to hire two people to go into this role here, why we need to buy a bunch of noise-canceling headphones, which is one of those ones that when people are going to return to office, why do we need noise-canceling headphones? Well, okay, there you go. There's your reason. It's a creative environment that people need to be able to concentrate in without being distracted. But yes, yeah, so being able to convey the importance and understanding of that from a people's perspective, I think, is also crucial. Do you have any sort of particular approaches or tips that you have for relaying that to leadership teams that are non-technical?
Well, explaining to them the value of some of the more senior engineering capability and the value of that cost. How do I explain that?
And the approach, the processes, the methods, the costs that go with it, the time. Normally it's extra time. It takes time to do these things. It's normally the main thing to justify, isn't it? But yeah.
Although it also can be the opposite, right? Because I think there's a cartoon is in there that was circulating for a while where a guy is on a ship somewhere and they have a problem. The engine won't start. And so they call up an engineer to come and fix it. And he says, you know, he walks down, looks around, you know, hits something with a hammer, and then the engine starts. And then he sends them a bill for, you know, $1,000 or something. And they go, how can you charge $1,000 when you spend 5 minutes? And he's like, it's not 5 minutes. It's 30 years of experience that led me to 5 minutes to figure out where to hit the thing with the hammer, right?
I love that story. The funny thing is, I actually chased that one down a while back and figured out where it came from. And it turns out that it does actually have an origin in a genuine story that happened. And it was recorded it was a ship indeed. It was recorded in the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich, is where they found the original story. And it's been republished and retold and morphed a number of times. But the original story is not far off what you just mentioned, actually. But essentially it's that, isn't it? It's not about the 10 seconds it took to hit the machine with a hammer in the right place. It's the 30 years it took to build the intuition to hit there first.
Yeah. And that was what I was saying about this almost sixth sense that you get when you're regularly coding and you're deep in a code base, that you just know you know about a problem and you know pretty much where to go, and you don't know how you know where to go, right? And in fact, you know, it's related to this was something I read a few years ago, which was there was a, it was actually a lady, a woman who was a coder, was somewhere near Bristol, and she was autistic, and she knew, she could remember every single line of code she'd ever written.
Wow.
And it was just extraordinary. So they said, you know, we would have a bug and she'd go, oh yeah, it's in this library. It's probably line 50 to 55. I think there's a, you know, there's an if statement in there that, and she was just going to fix it. I just remember thinking, that's amazing. That's amazing.
Absolutely amazing. And to be able to find out who those people are and figure out you've got those people within your team, definitely brilliant. Make sure you keep them as well. Cool. So if we try and summarize a little bit of all the wonderful things we covered there then. So you start off by saying that the CTO role is lonely, that it's a role that requires huge empathy to be able to have a significant impact with. Number one, understand the team. Have a chat with almost every single one of them. Make sure you're looking out for things like dissatisfaction, people who've got the potential to move into another role, whether that's leadership or what do you call it, a fire jumper. Also look out for the people at risk, which is a fairly obvious one. But by doing it systematically, I guess you can find the people at risk and therefore find the issues that cause that. And then thank goodness for the rise of the individual contributor. Celebrate those, make sure that they have a role and a recognition within where they are. And of course, represent and support those to the rest of your colleagues in the C-suite, your first team.
Yeah, fair summary. But I think on this, you know, the supporting individual ambition, there's this kind of a few other pointers with that, right? So there's obviously making sure that you have clear progression paths. So another thing I think a lot of, especially smaller tech companies, scale up ones where they're putting the process in place, which is, you know, the competencies, the responsibilities, making sure it's clear what is required for promotion so that when somebody does something, they see a clear link through what they did and that and how they advanced, right, for that. Encouraging the sort of internal projects, the innovation time. And I think that the sort of Google 20% has been not discredited, but it's not as popular. But you can do other things. You can have hackathons, you can have dedicated innovation sprints. There are other things you can do. And then, you know, carving out budget for continued education. And unfortunately, that's one of the ones where I've battled a few times to do that, where I haven't had full, you know, most of the time I've had full control of my budget, but there have been times when I haven't. And then there's always a battle like, oh, you know, I want to give each engineer £1,000 a year, right? To go and have some training, trying to justify that one, which should never have to be justified, right?
Should be harsh. You know, I've always found that it depends massively on where you are in the economic cycle at a given time.
Exactly. It does. It does. So yeah, I think there's quite a few other things around to support it. And then, you know, fostering mentorship, you know, peering people, which can be helpful as well when you have new people come on board, right? So all of those kind of activities are quite useful as well.
And do you focus on internal mentorship or do you ever encourage mentorship from outside the organization?
Well, obviously, I mean, I do it myself as just something that I do through a couple of organizations. But when I've been in companies, I don't think I've ever brought somebody in externally. That's actually a good question. I don't know why that's never come up. But usually it's just been something internally. So where someone has expressed, well, I know that one company where we had a DevOps team, you know, there was a young lady that joined that DevOps team, and she expressed a quite clear desire that at one point she wanted to be a head of DevOps, right? That was her ambition. And so we had a conversation with the person who was saying, look, you know, can we sort of come up with something to help guide her to that role? And you know, we did that. And I think she was quite grateful for that, actually. I don't know where she is now. I don't know if she's now a head of DevOps. She should be.
I hope so, if you did that right. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I've certainly done it I don't think I've ever brought anybody in externally to do any mentoring. It's usually just been something internally, either myself or somebody else who's in a position to do that for someone more junior.
Yeah. So I think where I've done that in the past is where I've got somebody who's become so senior that there's almost nobody else in the organization who would be, you know, senior or even a peer to them. And at that point, I said, you know, maybe it's worth looking out in the wider industry, look in your peer group, start talking out and attending conferences to establish yourself and then find out who are the you know, the pinnacles of this and make a relationship, create a relationship with them just to get going. And I think it's the same thing with coaching as well, where you've got specific things that teams need to pick up. I always suggested that either, you know, training, group training, formal training works quite well, I think, to help level up people. And that's one of those things where I found it generally easier to find budget for. I want to have this specific training course that runs for this amount of time. It costs this much. I've normally found that easier to get approved than a general pot of money for people to go for when times have been lean.
Oh, that's a good top. There's a top tip there. I like that. Okay.
And then coaching for individuals, especially people who are the sort of the top of their game or where they are. You know, if they run out of places to go to get higher, coach them so that they can, you know, provide even more value or different value across your business.
I tell you, actually, you made me think. One place that I did see, we did bring in people as part of a sort of coaching mentoring, which was very valuable. And in fact, I would definitely do it again, which is, we're talking about a hiring process, right? So hiring to me is often very broken. We can spend a whole discussion around that, right? But one of the things that, just like managing people is not really taught, interviewing is not really taught. And interviewing is so important, right? I mean, it's not only the place where you're learning about the candidate's learning about your business. So it's a two-way, absolutely it is. But, you know, you suddenly go, oh, you've got a junior engineer. Oh, go and drop in that interview process for this new hire. And they've never interviewed anyone in their life and they don't understand, they don't know how to even approach that. So one company I was at, this was a few years ago, actually, they bought in, and this wasn't my request. It came in because we had a new HR person and she was actually very big on this. She said, look, you know, you need to get people trained up, give them some help to understand how to run an interview process. And so this company came in and they did, and it was really valuable. I learned a lot in the process too. And I learned some things about, you know, what you should do, what you shouldn't do, you know, competency-based interviews. That was when they'd started to become quite popular, right? And they still are. And, training people in the interview process, understanding, how to actually ask people questions, you know, to listen and not just to talk, all those kind of things, which seem obvious, but if you've never done it, you can just throw somebody in there, you're not going to get the right result, really.
Yeah, no guidelines, no framework. You're going to end up with a relatively mediocre outcome, aren't you? That's a really great tip, actually, to get specific training for the recruitment process. I don't think I've ever come across that either. I've always learned from others who've been within the organization who've done plenty of recruitment in the past. And I've been lucky enough to work at some very high scaling organizations. Like, for example, I was at Palantir, who had a very specific approach to scaling because they had to hyperscale. So recruiting people pretty much faster than you can bring them on board. And so therefore the whole recruiting and onboarding process is very structured and therefore taught as a result of that. So I've been fortunate to have that myself. But yeah, getting recruitment training, I think, is hugely valuable, as you said. And that's interesting because you saw that impact in that organization straight away, but then I presume you took some of those lessons into your subsequent roles as well then.
Yeah. So it was interesting. There was a couple of reasons why this was done in this company. So the company itself, their location, so they were in a space doing computer vision hardware and were struggling to hire engineers because of where they were, right? They weren't, you know, Google and the big tech guys were throwing massive salaries around, and they still are in the computer vision space, right? I mean, AI is probably overtaking it, but it was computer vision for a long time with self-driving cars and all the rest of it. So it was like, how do we find these people? Because what we were seeing was people would come in and it was taking forever to hire. People were dropping out of the pipeline. And it was like, you know, something is really wrong with our whole hiring process. So this company came in to look at it, you know, root to branch, right? What is it that we're doing? They completely changed everything about the hiring process, and they did included interview training as well.
Brilliant. Good stuff. Well, we started this conversation by talking about tech captains. It might be a good way to round it out as well. So what's next for tech captains and for you in particular, Gareth?
Yeah. So tech captains it's on hiatus at the moment. So Ron, my co-host, he's very, very busy with his company. He's doing very, very well. And so what we've done, we paused it. We did, I think, 40 episodes in a year and a half, which is amazing to think about it. Yeah. And you know, it was great because I love learning about people. One of the reasons that I wanted to do it was Ron had started doing these interviews in a written form. And I messaged him and said, did he want to do a podcast? Just because I'm very nosy about people. I always ask people, you know, how did you get to, where do you come from? You know, how did you get to be a software developer? So it sort of satisfied that curiosity I have about people. But what I'm doing now is I'm doing some shorter, much shorter video segments, which will still be under the Tech Captains banner. We're calling them single shots. So there'll be one shorter video, maybe 4 or 5 minute long, around a specific topic. So it might be technical, might be business, could be anything that is interesting, really. So I'm going to be recording, got the first one ready, got everything written up, ready to go, researched. Going to record that this evening. I've actually done 5 takes of it, but had some issues with lights and various other things, but finally ready to record that this evening. So that will probably go up on the weekend. And then I'm going to try and do, you know, a couple a month or something like that, because these are, like I say, they're much shorter content.
So by the time that this one's released, you should be able to have a couple to go listen to, a few more shorts to go and listen to on your commute.
Yeah, and hopefully people will find them interesting. I mean, it's I think generally, if you find something interesting yourself, other people will. There'll be an audience, right? If you're interested and you have an obvious interest in something, it comes through, as opposed to when you're just doing it for the sake of doing it, right?
So are you interviewing people, or is that just going to be purely your own content for the New Tech Captains shorts?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about interviewing people, to be honest with you. I thought they would just be me talking on a topic, but we'll just see. Like, I've got about 10 ideas at the moment. This will be the first one.
And so where can somebody find it? They have to just find that by searching on their favorite platform for it?
Yeah, so it'll be on, I'm going to just put them onto YouTube initially. I'll post them onto LinkedIn as well. So if anyone follows me, they'll see them when they go on there. And I can tell you what the first one's going to be titled. It's going to be interesting to see if you'll be thinking, what on earth are you going to be talking about? So I'm going to talk about the Lambda Lith.
Right.
Do you know what that is?
Got to explain that a bit.
It's a portmanteau of Lambda and monolith.
Right, okay.
Yeah, so maybe now you have a slightly better understanding. You're still thinking, what on earth is that? I still don't know what the hell
that
is.
But now I'm intrigued to go and find out what it is when it comes available.
Well, there you go. Watch the episode. I'll tell you all about what it is and why you should be interested and why you might even want to be using them. So there you go.
Excellent. Sounds intriguing. Guys, it's been absolutely wonderful to speak to you today. Thanks very much for your time and for your views and for your playbook on looking after people within your engineering organization.
All right. Thanks, Adam. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks so much. Talk to you soon. Thank you very much for listening all the way through to the end. Just before you go, I'd like to ask you for one thing in return for putting together all these episodes of the CTO Playbook podcast for you. Please leave a review. Wherever you're listening, whether that is Apple Podcasts or Spotify or whichever platform you're on, leaving a quick review will help more CTOs find the podcast and enable me to create more great episodes. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of the CTO Playbook.